Hello, everyone. It's working? Yeah, very good. All right. It's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Peter Venable. Peter is a computer scientist with a deep interest in linguistics. He taught himself to code at an early age and earned a bachelor's degree in computer science from Seattle Pacific University, followed by a PhD from Carnegie Mellon, in which he focused on parsing and translation of natural language. Peter then joined a startup called Haley Systems to build artificial intelligence systems such as natural language inference engine. After Haley was acquired by Oracle in 2009, Peter moved back to the Northwest to join Logos Bible Software. Peter is going to be talking about building a semantic clause database of the Greek New Testament. Please join me in welcoming him.
Hi, thanks for choosing my talk. Today I'd like to tell you about a semantic clause database of the Greek New Testament, what it is, how we built it, and what new possibilities it creates for exploring the text. The semantic clause database we created is a database of all the clauses found in the Greek New Testament with semantic annotations. So what do I mean by semantic? Without getting bogged down in semantics, the semantic annotations I'm talking about are they precisely identify entities, people, places, things, and their relationships to each other in a machine-readable way. So, for example, let's take the Logos Bible Knowledge Base. Bible Knowledge Base is a machine-readable general knowledge base of reference information about the Bible using semantic web standards and tools. You could think of it as a list of people, places, and things mentioned in the biblical text with specific identifiers so you don't get confused two people with the same name, plus some other structured information. Sean Boysen has described it in detail in past Bible Tech talks, and I think he'll be talking about it again tomorrow. The Bible Knowledge Base also tracks where in the Bible each entity is mentioned, down to the verse level, but until now it hasn't identified at the word level, just to the verse level. But this project changes that. Referent analysis added a whole new level of detail to the Bible knowledge base. Dr. Steve Runge analyzed each word of the Greek New Testament and marked every reference to an identifiable person, place, or thing with a semantic tag that's compatible with the Bible knowledge base. So this includes named references, descriptive phrases, pronouns, and implicit subjects of verbs. Oh, it just got louder. That means the new referent database is not only more fine-grained, identifying specific words rather than whole verses, but also more complete because it includes implicit references previously omitted from the Bible knowledge base. And as I said, Steve worked in the original Greek, not in English. I just should have that. This is a big step forward because it gives us the ability to search for an entity and find hits that a text-based search engine would miss while omitting false matches due to multiple people having the same name. It also makes it easy to link from any word in the text to information about the person, place, or thing being referenced. However, the surface-level referent analysis has a few shortcomings. One is the narrow scope of each annotation. That is, semantic tags are typically attached to specific words rather than broader phrases. For many purposes, this is exactly what you want, but it can also be a weakness if you want to know the referent of a selected phrase, but only the part of the phrase is annotated. For example, let's take the phrase Bethlehem of Judea. The word Bethlehem is tagged with the place identifier for Bethlehem, and the word Judea is tagged with the place identifier for Judea. We would also like to know that the whole phrase refers to Bethlehem. But the raw data doesn't tell us that. And I'll come back to this. A second shortcoming is the omission of some implied references. In many cases where the syntax of a clause indicates that two phrases refer to the same entity, only one phrase was annotated, leaving gaps in the data. Gaps easily filled by a reader who understands the language, or possibly by a computer that can apply morphology and syntax. By the way, I don't mean this as a criticism of Steve's excellent analysis. It's mainly because he anticipated the solutions I'm about to show you that he took that kind of shortcut in the analysis. Finally, and this is more of an opportunity than a shortcoming, the referent annotations don't show how they fit together. They note where specific people, places, and things are mentioned, but don't show how those entities interrelate with each other. For example,
It might be interesting to know that Mark 6:48 mentions Jesus and mentions the Sea of Galilee, but it's much more interesting to know that Jesus was walking on the sea. A great way to extend the referent annotations would be to annotate whole clauses with the semantic entities that act as their subject, object, etc., or better yet, their semantic roles, such as agent, patient, and location. Obviously, given enough time, it'd be possible for a language expert to go through the text in detail and make all those annotations. But that's a lot of work. So how could we get these annotations more easily? Well, as you may have guessed, I'm going to argue that syntax is going to help us. Using syntax graphs, we can automatically identify whole phrases that are currently annotated only on the most important words. We can find omitted referents that are implied by the syntax and morphology, and we can find how entities participate in clauses. So thanks to Andy Wu and Randall Tan of the Asia Bible Society, we have these wonderful syntax graphs that show a hierarchical structure of the text with labeled heads and constituent types. How can we use them to improve our referent annotations? Look again at the noun phrase Bethlehem of Judea. With a syntax graph, a computer can know that this is a noun phrase consisting of a noun phrase that's its head, Bethlehem, plus another phrase of Judea. The head is syntactically and morphologically the most important part of the phrase, so it typically also carries the most salient semantics as well. This is certainly true in this case. The whole phrase, Bethlehem of Judea, has the same semantic referent as its head, Bethlehem, which is what we want to determine automatically. We can turn this case into a simple rule. A noun phrase consisting of a head noun phrase plus another phrase has the same semantics as its head, unless specified otherwise. That works in this case, and in about 32,000 other cases in the Greek New Testament. Now, would it still work if we made it even more general, such as any phrase has the same semantics as its head? Well, no, that turns out to be too inclusive, so we have to use several specific rules like this one. However, we can still make a generalization about the kind of rules that are needed to find the referent of a phrase based on the reference of its parts. The task of the rules is to determine when we can correctly propagate semantics up the syntax tree. This rule is one such case. It propagates the semantics up from a noun phrase to its parent if the child phrase acts as the head of the parent phrase. So in the case of Bethlehem, this rule propagates the semantics Bethlehem up from a noun phrase to the parent noun phrase, which it's the head of that parent noun phrase, Bethlehem of Judea. Besides finding the entities referred to by bigger phrases, there's another benefit of propagating semantics of the syntax tree. If we propagate the semantics right up to the clause level, we can find the relationships between the various entities mentioned in the clause. All we need to do is find the semantic reference of the syntax nodes that indicate clausal functions, such as subject, direct object, indirect object of the clause, and so on. Then we can compile these into a database of clauses and their arguments, enabling some exciting new ways of exploring the text, which I'll show you in a few minutes. So the 20 or so rules for propagating semantics up the tree to the clause level are pretty similar to the simple rule for noun phrases, but they deal with various special cases in Greek syntax and with the way it was analyzed in the cascaded syntax graphs. And I don't want to turn this into a lecture on Greek grammar, which I'm not really qualified to do anyway, so I won't go into too much more detail about those rules, but I will go into detail about how the rules are implemented after one more example. Let's look at a slightly more complex example, then tackle a different kind of problem. So Matthew 3:10, therefore every tree not producing good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. The word tree is annotated with the semantic tag for the entity tree, and our rules can easily determine then that the subject of that verb phrase is tree, the verb translated cut down. However, we didn't have an annotation on the verb thrown to know what its subject is. So we can write a rule that handles this case. If two clauses are joined by a conjunction and the clauses agree in person, number, and gender, then the clauses have the same subject. Now, it's important that the two clauses have the same person, number, and gender, or the rule would apply in places that don't make sense. Well, it's probably obvious to those who are into linguistics. Let's take a simple example. This sentence, ask and it will be given to you, would fit this rule, except ask is second person plural, and it will be given is third person singular, so the morphology doesn't agree, so the rule doesn't apply here, which is good because we don't want to incorrectly conclude that it is the same as you. So anyway, to apply our conjunction rule, we check that these two conjoined phrases have the same morphology, person, number, and gender, and then we infer the subject of the second clause. Any questions before I move on? That went fast. Already halfway done. So far, we've covered semantic annotations and syntax rules. Next are some technical details, and then I'll show you some new ways of exploring the Bible using semantic data. To me, the most interesting technical bits, other than the Greek linguistics, are the expressiveness of the rule language and the algorithm that applies the rules. Before designing the rule language, we observed that the rules we expected to write had a few useful properties. When a rule applies, its effect is usually to propagate a semantic tag up to the parent node of the syntax tree from one or more of its children. The applicability of a rule depends on just a few things: the set or sequence of child nodes, the type of each node, such as is it a noun phrase, prepositional phrase, clause, etc., morphological agreement between the nodes, and the semantic tags that are annotated on those nodes. Importantly, the applicability of a rule does not depend on nodes outside the subtree to which the rules apply. Thus, the rules are context-free. Keep in mind that the rules can apply recursively at any node, which means a rule can add a tag to a node, and then that node could be an input to another rule that applies to its parent node, and so on. Keeping the scope of each rule local allows a simpler algorithm to efficiently order the rules, because we know changes flow only from the leaves to the root. It's also good for performance that we only need to look at a node as direct children rather than the whole subtree. So given these constraints, the algorithm for applying the rule is pretty simple. Basically, follow this outline. For each syntax tree, for each depth of tree in the node starting from the deepest, and we look at each node at that depth, and for each rule determine if the rule applies, and then if it applies, update that node's semantics. Now, if we allowed the rules to modify just any node rather than just the topmost node that the rule looks at, this algorithm would not guarantee correct results. Instead, every time a rule fired, we'd have to recheck every rule that could potentially be affected by the change we made. It's even worse than that because the outcome could depend on the order in which the rules are considered, and it would even be possible to write rules that never terminate. But in our case, we can guarantee that the rule process terminates in time proportional to the number of nodes times the number of rules. We can also guarantee that it gets the same results regardless of what order the rules are considered. With just a minor additional constraint to the rule language, we can get that guarantee. In order to get that guarantee, it would suffice either to require all the rules to be mutually exclusive or to prevent rules from being sensitive to the semantic tags already propagated by the rules, to the current node being checked by the rule. So, in practice, once we started writing real syntax rules, we found the need to relax two of the assumptions that made our algorithm so nice and simple. Some of our rules needed to look at the grandchildren of the node. Fortunately, that doesn't really break anything. The second assumption we broke was a bit trickier, and one of the examples I shared illustrates it. Did anyone notice a contradiction between one of my example rules and the assumptions I declared? If you remember this rule, you might observe that it says two sibling clauses have the same subject, which means it propagates a semantic tag across from a sibling node to a sibling node rather than up to a parent node. This could be a problem for the simple algorithm I showed you because updating sibling node could affect the applicability of other rules whose turns already passed, requiring the algorithm to backtrack. Fortunately, it's not that hard to fix the algorithm to handle this situation. Even more fortunately, everywhere in the Greek New Testament that this rule applies, backtracking doesn't actually change the results. So in practice, we didn't need to change our algorithm to deal with this complexity. So that was the algorithm. Now a few more words about the rules. Each rule has a few basic parts. It applies to one or more types of nodes, such as a noun phrase or verb phrase. Matching nodes have one or more child nodes. The rule specifies whether or not the order of the child nodes matters. So it could be a sequence or it could just be a set. Child nodes can also be optional or repeatable. Each node in a rule, including the parent and children, can have constraints, and each constraint specifies some feature of the node, paired either with a variable to match another constraint, so you're matching this subnode has this feature that's the same as that other subnode having the same feature, or it can just specify a variable, a value, or a regular expression, or some pattern. So the types of features that can be constrained include the type of node, whether or not the node is the syntactic head of its parent node, morphological features such as person, number, and gender, and of course the semantic tags. In the case of semantic tags, we can optionally accumulate multiple bindings rather than just matching, which allows conjunction rules to propagate semantics from both sides of conjunctions. So you have James and John has the semantics pulled from both sides joined together. And as I mentioned at the last minute, we added grandchild nodes, which act the same as child nodes, except they're nested inside child nodes. There's no great-grandchild nodes. Any questions about the algorithm or rule language?
Yes? Can you say a little bit about the computational complexity? You said that it's...
Yeah, so if we look back at the algorithm...
How many rules do you have, and how many senses and nodes are there in the New Testament?
Right, so there's about 20-some rules. So here, let's see, this is pretty much a simple nested loop. So so the cost of running this is proportional to the number of sentences or clauses in the text, which I don't have the number in my head, but it's a few tens of thousands, I think, somewhere on that order. And then even though we're going by depths of nodes in the tree, that doesn't actually